The recording has started.
Thank you, Patricia. Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. This is the IRTPB call, and on this call we have Barbara Steele, James Bladel, Mikey O'Connor, Kevin Erdman, Matt Serlin, Paul Diaz, and for staff we have Marika Koenigs, David Gieser, Olaf Nordling, and Glenda Sangeri myself. And we have apologies from our chair, Michele Nilon. Thank you, James. Over to you.
Thank you, Glenn, and good morning, good day, everyone. This is the IRTP call for Tuesday, April 27th, 2010. And as Glenn mentioned, our chair is absent, so I will be the substitute teacher today. I hope that's all right with everyone.
Spitballs at the ready.
I noticed there were several folks in the roll call that are not showing up on the Adobe Connect, and since we will be looking at some documents there, if it is at all possible for folks to join Adobe, I think the URL was in the invitation, so please do so if you can, assuming you're not at an airport or behind the wheel. If either of those are the case, or the latter, please do not go to Adobe Connect. So there's an agenda that is posted in the top window there on Adobe and that Marika had sent around, a few items. But I think if the group doesn't mind, I'd like to start with item towards the bottom right before item four and just talk a little bit, maybe take the first 10 minutes of this call to discuss scheduling. The document cutoff to ensure that a initial report from this group would be released by and open for comment by the Brussels meeting would be May 31st. Am I correct in that, Marika?
Yes, that's correct. That's 15 business days before the start of the ICANN meeting. And apologies, okay. I think I earlier communicated, I think, 4th of June, but I actually counted days and not business days.
Understood. Thank you for that clarification. So that gives us 4 meetings, not including this one that we're just starting, to complete the issues that Marika has listed in the issues A through E, finalize the language in the report, and submit that for public comment. And like many of you, I'm a participant on several working groups, and I can tell you that all of them are eyeing the 31st as a finish line and are racing towards that date. So, you know, I can imagine what staff is going through trying to get all those things finalized for Brussels. So if we can, I would recommend that we push through with these remaining items and make the best, most optimal use of our 4 remaining meetings. And if necessary, if we feel that that date is in jeopardy, maybe schedule an interim meeting or subgroup meetings or whatever we can to make sure that we don't miss that date. Any thoughts or concerns with that approach? I just wanted to emphasize the significance of making that cutoff. And I see Marika's hand.
Yeah, this is Marika. Because one point I just wanted to make is, you know, when we start looking at the different recommendations for the different issues, I think we need to take into account as well that it concerns an initial report. So these don't need to be final recommendations yet that are, you know, completely worked out, or, you know, there might be areas where the group has different options it would like to take under consideration or get input from the community on. So I think as well that, you know, the group should try to maybe see, to get to the deadline as an opportunity as well of maybe putting out ideas instead of trying to really, you know, have every dot and comma in the right place, because there still will be time following the initial report to review the comments and the input received and to really finalize and take that input into, you know, really finalizing those recommendations.
Thank you, Marika. Mikey, you're next.
Thanks, James. This is Mikey. I would sort of concur with that. I think one of the things I'm running into is that it's really hard to schedule sub-team calls now because there are so many work groups all competing for that unscheduled time. And so to the extent that we can really be productive on the scheduled calls, I think we'll be better off, get better participation, and run into less trouble. I'm speaking from experience on the VI side, and I'm sure that if we get all 7 working groups that I'm on competing for the time, that pretty soon I'll just say goodbye to my sweetheart and dial into ICANN at 6 in the morning and go straight till midnight. So let's try and really beat on the schedule calls. And I like Marika's notion that maybe this is a rough cut. And if it's not quite perfectly smooth, but we have the major issues identified, we're probably good to go.
Good points, Mikey and Marika. I would agree with one qualifier, is that I think that when initial reports are released, they do tend to take on a certain degree of inertia. While they do change between the initial and the final, I think that they probably are 80% of the recommendations are contained in one, show up in the other. So I would say let's not be hasty in putting together the initial report, because those things tend to take on a life of their own once they're out in the wild, so to speak. Okay. Well, with that said, oh, there's Mikey again. Is that a new hand?
Yeah, I'm just winking at you. I think that one of the big advantages of coming up with a rough cut and maybe some caveats that say, look, this is going to go through a fairly substantial revision, is that the time between Nairobi and Brussels is a lot shorter than the time between Brussels and the next meeting. And so we have a little less schedule compression. So, you know, maybe it's sort of a blanket statement across all these working groups. We sort of say, you know, look, people, we have a little bit more time to work between the next, you know, this meeting and the next. So don't panic.
Okay, thanks. I like the part about not panicking. Okay, so were there any other thoughts on schedules or timelines? I think that making the most of our time, but recognizing that this is an interim report and not final recommendations is a good approach. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika, because I think one of the main reasons of trying to get this done in time for the Brussels meeting, that of course there we'll have an opportunity to, you know, discuss it with the community and have a workshop or some kind of information session to try to, you know, explain the issues and you know, where we stand on the recommendations, and try to encourage people to provide input as part of the public comment forum. And to Mikey's point, that there's more time between the Brussels meeting and the Latin America or the South America meeting, and it's to a certain extent less relevant, because I think the final report doesn't necessarily need to be submitted in time for an ICANN meeting. Basically, that report will go straight to the GNSO Council, and that could be submitted, you know, at any point, you know, when the working group is basically ready. The only, you know, deadline there is that for the GNSO Council to consider it, it would need to be submitted 8 days before you know, their next meeting, so they have time to review it and add it to the agenda. Unless, of course, there's, you know, a need or a desire of the working group to present the report in person to the council and allow for Q&As. I mean, that's something else that you might want to consider. But I think, you know, there's more pressure now to try to get it in time for Brussels to allow for that live community discussion and you know, hopefully get some good input and feedback on the issues the group will put forward.
Thank you. That's a good point. I think Paul raised a good point in the chat as well, that the summer months traditionally see attendance problems, and I think working groups struggle to achieve quorum, let's say, between mid-July and the end of August, when folks are you know, rightfully taking time with their families. So it may be a little bit of extra time before the Latin American meeting, Mikey, but some of that time may be an illusion. I think Marika makes a good point about outside of Brussels, not necessarily tying the output of this group in, to a general meeting unless we are expecting a workshop or a presentation. Okay. Any other thoughts on scheduling or timeline? Okay. The queue is clear, so let's move into the agenda and jumping back to number one. And I don't seem to be able to scroll that anymore. Okay, Adobe's acting up for me. So I think item number one was relative to the expedited transfer reverse process, the ETRP. And Marika's posted something that I sent to the sub-team back on April 18th, where I had received some offline feedback. And I thought that perhaps we could just take 10 to 15 minutes here to discuss these issues and then start to begin to at least put a bow on the recommendations and, of course, leaving open the idea that we would receive further comments on these when they're in the initial report or when they're raised during the next meeting. So with your agreement, I would like to dive into the list of four items that are on the screen now. Okay? Okay. So the first one is with regard to Section 3.1 of the ETRP, and to, as a reminder, you know, we established that the transfer, the request for a reversal had to be initiated by the pre-transfer registrar. This individual mentioned that there is no incentive for the pre-transfer registrar to cooperate with the registrants claiming that they're a victim of hijacking. I'm not sure that that's always true. I think it's possible that that's the case. But, for example, you know, I think that, you know, in the mode of customer service or even just wanting to retain that particular customer, that a pre-transfer registrar would have enough incentive to cooperate. But it's possible that if there were risks or if they felt that the situation were questionable, that they might not willingly jump into initiating the ETRP. So if we can start a discussion on that, and I see Mikey in the queue.
Thanks, James. It's Mikey. I think that that's where my notion that there needs to be a route to escalation is important. My thought is that if the PTR doesn't respond, then, you know, through education, through community, through whatever, we should make it clear that the registrant's next step is to escalate it to ICANN enforcement. Send David after them with a stick.
Thank you, Mikey.
anytime.
A big stick.
A big stick. So that I think that's my immediate reaction to that question is that there is an incentive that's negative if the sort of positive incentives that you're describing, James, don't work. Clearly, the word would get around pretty fast in the community if a registrar was unresponsive. You know, the customer service chatter would be pretty compelling as well, but I think ultimately the path is to escalation.
Okay, good point. Before I jump to Michael, David, did you want to respond to that? I mean, what would be compliance's actions now if they were dealing with an uncooperative registrar? You would enforce the policy by what?
Yeah, essentially we would start with an email dialogue with the registrar, pointing out to the registrar where they're deficient with respect to the policy, and then give them essentially anywhere between 5, 7 to 10 days to respond back. Presuming that they still remain unresponsive, then the next step would be to escalate that into a compliance notice, and then you know, transmit the compliance notice via an email in an effort, again, to get the non-responsive or uncooperative registrar to take some action. If they fail to take action, then it would be escalated to a breach notice, and we don't do that often because generally registrars respond before you get to the third strike.
Okay. Just playing devil's advocate here for just a moment. What if that the reason for the pre-transfer registrar's uncooperation was that they did not believe that the claim of hijacking was legitimate.
And then it gets much more difficult because there's no particular clarity in the policy in terms of how to deal with that situation. So then it's a it might require an escalation, you know, up through compliance into, you know, ICANN's legal department, or, you know, potentially an escalation to, you know, over to the registrar liaison team for, you know, for some sort of, you know, cooperative solution if you can find one. If you can't, you know, then we're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place where it becomes, you know, difficult to take the action I just described.
Okay. Michael?
Yeah, this question maybe for David as well, too. And the scenario that James just described, you felt that it might be difficult. But my question is, what if a registrar just doesn't respond to a request by a registrant? Where in the policy is there a requirement for the registrar to file a transfer dispute? My understanding, it's available to the registrar, but I'm not familiar enough with the policy, but where is it required that they do so? That's all.
Yeah, the short answer is I don't believe it is required. And Marika might, you know, want to, you know, assist me with this point as well, but, you know, this could be an opportunity for a policy change that makes it clear, you know, that this is required. But right now we're really working off of what I call the the cooperative good graces of registrars who, you know, are attempting to do what's in, let's say, the best interest of registrants. But clearly, if that doesn't result in action, our hands are literally tied. We can't force the registrar to take action.
Okay, I put myself in the queue, but I see that Paul is up as well. Go ahead, Paul.
Thanks, James. We may be saying the same thing. Look, here, I think we want to be careful about making this a requirement. This would definitely fall into the unintended consequences, because by requiring a registrar to file the process, you're going to obviate what is in the real world the most often the quick fix, which are the personal connections between registrars working behind the scenes to address an issue. If we mandate it, this working group mandates that a registrar must file and start the process, essentially you're going to guarantee that it's going to take weeks into months rather than hours into maybe a few days, as things are typically done. In the case of a non-responsive registrar, you know, I'm going to assume that it's not the losing registrar who's non-responsive, it's the gaining registrar who allegedly received a jacked name, in which case, I mean, that's what, you know, the whole expedited transfer dispute or transfer resolution policy is all about. But again, I don't think we want to mandate that these tools, these processes have to be used, because process really is a synonym for red tape, and in the interest of the customer, I don't think you want to force registrars to have to go through what is undoubtedly going to be a longer-term process. Leave it at the discretion so that, again, we're providing as many tools as possible to try and get the end result that the registrant wants, get their name back.
Thank you, Paul. And I'm going to jump into my GoDaddy role here and agree. This process was, I think, intentionally designed to minimize the cooperation or eliminate cooperation requirements on the part of the registrar that received the hijacked name, and as a result, de-emphasize the cooperation of the as far as requiring cooperation from the pre-transfer registrant. I believe that the latter. The pre-transfer registrants are cooperating and are requiring looking for additional tools and mechanisms now. So I think that you know, the idea that that there would be a registrar who would not necessarily respond to a registrar is a problem that we have today. As David mentioned, it's a little more complex than it might appear on the surface, because it could be that a registrar is being dragged in to adjudicate a dispute which they don't feel comfortable based on the evidence that they have, that they would want to say, yes, this is a clear-cut case of hijacking, or no, this is an illegitimate claim. And I think including that as a requirement might tie the hands of a registrar that would otherwise be cooperative in terms of helping registrars in this situation, but it might make them gun-shy to use this process if they felt like they were signing on to as a party to a dispute. So I think that making that a requirement is possibly, it's something that we should steer clear of, and I think that, in fact, that I would even submit that that's a separate problem than what we're trying to solve with this document. Michael?
Well, thank you. James, I would like to say that while I don't disagree with anything you've said, and I do not think that there is no incentive for a losing registrar to be cooperative, I think that you've mentioned some cases where cooperation might be limited or withheld for other reasons, reasons that are important to the registrar. And all I ask is that we really need to be careful that we don't talk about involving compliance if compliance doesn't have anything to enforce, though. I mean, I think that we need to be clear that this is a voluntary, and because if you start talking about bringing in compliance, it suggests that compliance has some policy to enforce. That's all.
That's an excellent point. So the queue is empty. I think maybe we can conclude this topic with the thought that we have identified some incentives for a registrar to comply or to cooperate with this. We're not expecting cooperation from the registrar that receives the hijack name, and we are leaving some flexibility or discretion on the part of the pre-transfer registrar to stay away from something that they feel may be a false claim of hijacking or just a traditional dispute to avoid them taking sides in that dispute. Is that kind of what we're saying here, or am I missing any major omissions with that statement? Okay, she was clear. The second item that was raised to me was 3.2.1. We should seek wider feedback on the impact or consequences of making the 60-day lock mandatory. I think that the concern is that there are domain investors, the aftermarket service providers, and auction service providers that would have significant problems with that delay. Perhaps we could maybe preempt some of those concerns in the report or in the recommendation by stating something to the effect that we recognize that there is no way to completely eliminate the inconvenience to the aftermarket as far as the portability of domain name registrations, but that is part of the trade-off to have increased security and have increased confidence in the inventory of those marketplaces that they are legitimate registrations. And maybe we can say something to that effect and put that into our initial report and see if we can get some comments about making this 60-day lock mandatory. So I just wanted to maybe take 5 minutes on this, if we can open the queue for any comments on this. And I see Barbara first.
Hi, this is Barbara. I will say I did take an informal survey, and I'm hoping for some additional feedback, but the feedback that I did receive was that some of the registry operators actually have put in place a systematic restriction on transfers that occur within 60 days of a transfer. So once I have all of the information relative to the registry's implementation of that particular, I'll call it an option, which is available to the losing registrar, then I'll put that together and distribute it to the team.
Thank you, Barbara. And would that be something that you think could be included in our initial report?
I don't see why not.
If we don't name names?
Pardon?
If we don't name names or...
Well, I don't know that it even really matters. I think that, you know, if we just said, you know, registry by registry, you know, who
okay.
has already implemented that versus, you know, those who leave it up to the registrars to, you know, determine if the domain has transferred in 60 days and thereby NAC it.
Okay, thank you. I think that's a great idea and would help possibly build support for this idea.
Okay.
Mikey?
Hi, James. This is Mikey. Yeah, and I think another I liked your list, and I like Barbara's thing. I think another addition to the list is to make it clear that this is only when it's an inter-registrar transfer, that if I'm an aftermarket person and I want to move a name around to a bunch of registrants within the same registrar, this doesn't apply and thus mitigate the sort of pain of a 60-day transfer hold. You know, this is a fairly limited subset of all transfers, and if I were an enterprising auction provider, I would just make sure that I had accounts at the major registrars and leave the name within the registrar, and then this wouldn't apply.
Wouldn't apply necessarily, but I would submit that most registrars who honor the 60-day lock for transfers would do the same for internal change of registrants transactions.
Right. Oh, okay.
So I'm not saying that that's necessarily a given, but I would suspect that's the case.
We might want to clarify that
okay.
in our language, because it's just a choice. It's another dimension of it.
Right. Well, I think, and first I wanted to ask Marika, we're getting some good things here, but are we going too quickly, or are we capturing most of this? Or
the beauty of an MP3.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, this is Marika, because I'm not capturing this because I was under the impression that you would be updating the document following this call related to this issue, but...
I am now, yes. Okay.
I'm sorry, but as you had taken the lead on that one, I was, you know, just assuming that you would take it to the next level as well. But, you know, we can always talk offline about how to manage that.
No problem. I just wanted to make sure we were, and I think that the good news is we have an MP3 and a transcript. So, Michael.
I'm not sure really any further comments necessary, but I was also concerned, like Mikey, that it wasn't clear to me whether the 60-day lock referred to a registrant change or an IRTP transfer. Thank
well,
you.
In this particular draft recommendation, we're referring only to the IRTP.
Okay.
But I'm just, I think in the from a practical perspective, any registrar that honors that 60-day lock probably has an equivalent lock for change of registrants. I don't think it's required, and it's not spelled out in the policy. It's just more of an internal procedure. And to my knowledge, the change of registrant function, and this is where we get into longer discussions about some of GoDaddy's internal practices as well, the change of registrant function is not defined. We have built a pretty healthy secondary and commercial markets in this industry around the portability of domain names between individuals and entities, but in fact that was originally designed to allow one individual to exercise their choice and freedom to go to different registrars. So, you know, I think registrars have had to invent the change of registrar function on their own, supported internally, and I think very cautiously gauge the risk level that they're assuming by supporting that function. I think we've talked about this before. In ccTLDs, they call this a trade, right? So a lot of ccTLDs will support this. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was going to just say, yes, we have talked about it some in the past. But it wasn't clear in this particular document which 60-day lock we were referring to.
I think registrars might feel a little bit more comfortable with a tool like this in their back pocket to maybe and I'm saying this as gently as I can, but maybe be a little more flexible in their restrictions on change of registrant if they felt they had a solid, reliable anti-hijacking mechanism at their disposal.
I know you've spoke in the past for a reason not to include the registrant, not a registrant transfer initiating a lock. But I wonder if that wouldn't make one thing a little bit easier, and that's reducing the occasions where a registrant change takes place immediately, a hijacking occurs, let's suppose, and the hijacker changes the registrant and then immediately transfers it to another registrar. And now the initial registrant, it wasn't the registrant at the time of the IRPP transfer. So what rights do they have to contest that transfer is a question. I wonder if the 60-day registrant change lock would help in that scenario. And I know we've discussed, and I apologize if this particular issue has been covered, but I can't remember what was said. That's all.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. I think we have discussed it, but I don't know that we've arrived at any conclusions or included that in this draft. I think that's an important consideration. I think you're right. I think we need to spend some more time on that. But I do think that's sort of taking us a little bit off of this particular topic, but we should definitely circle back when we get to issue, I forget if it's D, I think it's D or some of those other issues on the agenda. Mikey.
Thanks, James. This is Mikey. I'm just going to sort of follow up to Michael's point, which is, I think we should be careful in linking this to anything beyond inter-registrar transfers, because as soon as we get into specifying transfers that stay within, specifying things about transfers that stay within the same registrar, we're pretty far outside the scope of this working group, among other things, and probably walking into an area that has a lot of other ramifications. So just sort of basically repeating my first point, which is that one of the advantages that a registrar has is that as long as the domain stays within the same registrar, they have a lot more flexibility in terms of recovering it. So we're kind of addressing a different problem there. So I'm just repeating myself. There you go.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mikey. And to Michael's earlier point, we do have a specific charter question just for that particular scenario that he's discussing, and I want to be sure that we're not blending them together too much, just so that we can get through this particular document. Mr. Serlin, good morning.
Good morning, James. I'm sensitive to spending too much time on this, but I just want to pick up. I agree with what Mikey just said, and I think I've probably been a pretty outspoken opponent to the 60-day. Lock when a change of registrant occurs, but Michael said something interesting that caught my attention, actually, in that if a hijacker changes the registrant and then transfers the name away, the previous correct, if you will, registrant then doesn't necessarily have any standing. So while I still don't think the blanket 60-day lock across the board is a good idea on registrant changes. I think what Michael brought up is probably something that's worth further discussion and making sure that whatever proposals we come up with have some mechanism to address that, because I can see that being a real issue.
Okay, thanks, Matt. And that's you're absolutely right. That is something we should spend some time, even if not in our initial report, perhaps putting those questions out for public comment with that submission, so that we can get a broader discussion going on those things. Okay, we have 20 minutes remaining. So moving on to Section 342, ID verification. There was concern from one individual that I think in the procedure we specified that the pre-transfer registrar must validate the identity of the person making the claim of hijack. And we didn't get too prescriptive in this area, because I think that we were trying to allow for different procedures, different jurisdictions, and different types of identification that were acceptable. But this person mentioned that it would be problematic, perhaps, for the registry or ICANN to verify or audit those. That the fact that the registrar, the pre-transfer registrar, did in fact verify the identity of the person claiming to be a hijack victim, how would they know? We talked about submitting those, either the identification or as part of an affidavit, as part of the packet of documents and supporting materials that would be sent to the registry when initiating this process. But I think the point is that. How would the registry know that that is legitimate, and how would ICANN know that that was actually done? Now, one thought I had here was that I think that the IRTP has some guidance that might serve as a model here, but I just wanted to throw that open to the queue for discussion.
Thanks, James. Honestly, isn't the fact that the pre-transfer registrar is stepping forward and assuming the liability for this in and of itself a pretty strong indicator that they've done some due diligence? Most times, registrars are seeking waivers or exemptions from liability, so I would think that would be a big one. As far as, whatever the forms are, we have FOAs. I thought we had discussed that there would be some kind of package or term that we weren't very, very detailed about in the proposal, what exactly that would entail. But there would certainly need to be something that the registrar attests to, says, yeah, we did the check. We looked at one of those forms of identification that's already, listed in existing ICANN policy. So it covers the range. It gives the flexibility. We're not saying it must be this or that, but you choose something off of the list that ICANN community has already developed. But the fact that the registrar is going through this process, I think, speaks volumes that it's done some level of due diligence and is confident that it's doing the right thing. And clearly, if it's a the policy is broken, and that we find a particular registrar is abusing it to essentially effect a reverse hijacking. Then that would be a case for compliance to look into. Hell, it might even become a civil case because it's fraud.
That's an excellent point. I especially like the phrase that you use, that registrars are notorious for running away from liability wherever they see it, but the fact that they're coming to a registry with an assumption of risk and a packet of materials in hand should speak volumes to the idea that they are they've done their due diligence and that they're confident that they know who they're dealing with. Yeah, that's an excellent point.
And without maligning any colleagues, I mean, everybody in the ICANN community beginning with ICANN is risk averse and seeks immunity and indemnity. I mean, it's just the nature of business in a litigious society, but I guess I'm missing something with, you know, that question or comment. It's like, wait a minute, you have a registrar stepping forward and saying we're doing this on behalf of a wronged registrant. I mean, that just speaks volumes.
I think the only folks in this industry that aren't risk averse are the criminals. And the criminals and the hijackers are the ones out there on the edge, and you know, that's probably one of the reasons why we're so cautious in responding to them sometimes. Mikey.
Actually, this last sentence you said, James, my question was, what's the problem that this question's trying to solve? And maybe that last little throwaway comment that you made is the problem, which is...
I make a lot of throwaway comments.
Yeah, I know. It's because we don't have anything better to do here in the Midwest. But is this person concerned about a scenario where a hijacking registrar... You know, I was trying to sort of put together the circumstances where the registry or ICANN would have to audit it. I mean, when would they have to do that? And the only one I can imagine is one where a registrar is hijacking names. And, you know, Paul's litany of remedies to that strikes me as pretty profound. But are there other circumstances? I'm trying to figure out the problem this person's trying to solve.
I think that it was just more of a general process question, where if you're requiring that the pre-transfer registrar collect document A, B, and C, and you're essentially using that to extend some confidence into the registry to execute this policy, that we have to have a way to, you know, we have to have a sanity check on those documents and the fact that they were actually collected and that they aren't turning in driver's licenses for historical figures or cartoon characters.
Well, so, but isn't it sort of self-documenting? I mean, you know, there's two ends to this thing. There's the end that the registrar is collecting the data, but then the other end is the registry that's saying, well, give me your stuff, and then they look at the stuff, and if it's not all there,
Well, but does that imply that the registry then has the right to say, no, this identification is not acceptable, or we do not, we reject this application based on the lack of identification?
Well, maybe that's the way to do it.
I'm okay having that discussion.
That's kind of a presumption I guess I made, was that, yeah, if you didn't have the identification pulled together, then no ticky, no laundry.
That's a good point. And I see Barbara in the queue before I could call on her. So thank you, Barbara.
Hi. Barbara, I guess from our perspective, I mean, we obviously would look for some form of identification to be submitted with any cases that are brought to the registry. But to everybody's point, I mean, if there are evil people out there, there are definitely a lot of people out there who can forge what looks like a government-issued identification, such as a passport or driver's license or, you know, federal ID card or what have you. So, you know, I think that it's important to practice due diligence, but, you know, the validation of that is tough. I mean, we've seen some pretty good forgeries of people, you know, sending in documents, trying to get access to accounts and what have you. So it's not to say that it's not going to be a 100% guarantee that the data is correct, and I don't know how you go about validating it other than, you know, we have, you know, relationships with the people that they were trying to represent themselves as being, and we knew that the picture on the IDs that they were providing were definitely not the individuals that they were posing to be. So I don't know, you know, how you get around it. I mean, obviously, I think it's important to have some form of ID. How you make sure that that's bulletproof, I don't know.
Okay, thanks. We're building quite a queue here. So David is next.
Just quickly, I wanted to agree with Barbara. Validation is really a key issue here. But from ICANN's perspective, as everyone on the call I think knows, we have some very strong audit rights now under the 2009 version of the RAA. And so, you know, when appropriate, you know, we would work, you know, collaboratively with the registrar to, you know, to request access to certain business records, you know, for the purpose of essentially establishing what data was collected and what processes the registrar deployed to to validate, that particular entity's identification. Now, I can't honestly say how that would work until we were in beta test mode, but I think we would use that process, when appropriate, to audit and then try to establish some some corrective action plan or process with the registrar, short of having to, initiate a compliance notice or a breach notice.
Okay, thank you, David. Kevin?
Yeah, when talking about the idea of ID verification, my question is there some procedure at the front end when the when a registrant first gets a domain name that is then countermatched on the back end with that verification? And would it be part of our purview to suggest that that might be something or some sort of standard for the whole process? Because part of the way that ID verification is going to work is that you get the right data in the front end before you can verify it on the back end.
I don't think we considered that. I think my initial reaction would be that if someone is willing to forge one, they're probably willing to forge both. But I haven't really thought of all the downstream implications of that.
Well, I mean, one thing that I was thinking about when this was going out is could, either at the front end, when someone is registering a domain, if they got some sort of unique token they could use to later verify a subsequent transfer, or just have some sort of standard identification requirement, because when we're looking at the emergency transfer because there has been some sort of forgery or something like that, the forger might not have access to the original documents that were submitted. So even if they can make a great forgery, if it's not identical to what was originally submitted, then that would be a way of making the ID verification more robust.
I think that's an interesting idea, and it might be something that registrars could or should do as part of verifying the ID, and submitting an affidavit to the registry that they are dealing with the person they think they're dealing with. I think it's quite another subject altogether to put that prescription or any process into this policy. I think we are deliberately trying to leave it as flexible as possible to account for different business models, different jurisdictions, et cetera. But I think it's a good recommendation for registrars that would choose to use that method as opposed to identifying it on the back end. Mikey, can I be rude here and say that we have 6 minutes left in our call, and the next item, I think, will probably consume all of those. So is this a quick one?
Shocked. No, I'll go away.
No, I wanted to close off this topic and keep this moving here, because I think when McKaylee comes back and he sees that I have taken his working group and made a lot of long-distance calls and drank all the beer in his fridge, I don't think he'll be very happy with my caretaking day here. So the last part here is it's a compound part here is that that there is no precedent in a consensus policy that specifies or limits the prices that registrars can charge to registrants. Now, I understand we had a very healthy discussion about the idea that you don't want to kick somebody when they're down or use the fact that they're now claiming hijack to as an opportunity to extort as you know what the market will bear in terms of a fee. On the other hand, I think that from a practical standpoint, we have to recognize that this could be a deal breaker in terms of registrar support and for this idea. And that it's without registrar support, it's effectively we're just talking at words on paper. One idea that I had, and I did kind of have a lengthy discussion with this person about this concern, was the idea that we don't specify what the price should be or limit it, but we specify instead that it is posted conspicuously in their registration agreement and in the ETRP affidavit or form, that we specifically, you know, give the hijacking victim visibility to that as early as possible, what they will be paying, and that the registrar is held to that whatever they said they would do at the beginning of the process is what is actually charged. I don't want to get too deep into the pricing discussion here, but I just wanted to point out that actually specifying prices would be uncharted waters for an ICANN consensus policy. So maybe we can take just a couple of minutes to discuss that, or if you guys think that's too big of a discussion, we can take it onto the list. But my compromise alternative would be to specify that it is posted and that they honor it, but not that we specify the amount. Michael?
Doesn't the existing registrar transfer dispute already specify a price?
This is the TDRP?
Correct.
I don't have that in front of me, so perhaps we can I see. Barbara, do you have a quick answer to that? Or
I think I might. I don't believe that the TDRP does specify the pricing. In fact, I think that you'd get into probably some antitrust issues if we were talking about specific pricing. But I can say that we, and I think that the other registry operators who provide that service do put it in their supplemental rules what their specific prices are.
Yeah, thank you, Barbara. I don't think there's any prices listed anywhere in terms of what registrars would charge to registrants. I think that registry or registrar fees are abundant in all the different agreements. But I think Barbara's correct. There've been some deliberate avoidance of that latter or that former price type. Mikey?
Yeah, I think this is Mikey. I think this is just pushing the pricing out one layer in the ring. And just like TDRP doesn't specify a price, but a registry does. I think in this case your compromise solution works where the policy doesn't specify a price, but registrars are responsible for setting and informing people of those prices, and then I think you're okay.
I can make that modification, and I think we should definitely include something to that effect in our initial report. I would just maybe hold out to this group that be prepared for registrars to pounce on that one. I think, you know, you're not going to see it from Paul or I or Michele or Matt or some of the folks that participate in the call and understand the context, but if someone maybe jumps down to the bottom of the recommendations and sees that out of context, they might assume the worst. So let's maybe dangle that out there and see who jumps at the bait, so to speak. That's a bad analogy. The last question, and it didn't refer to a specific section, but it was just essentially that that this process or this policy didn't really consider how it could be gamed or abused or used by reverse hijackers or folks, let's say unscrupulous registrars who were looking to reverse all transfers for a given week or month. Maybe they raise their prices or change their terms of service, and their customers were, bolting for the exits, and the registrar decided to, are there enough safeguards to prevent this process from inadvertently becoming the world's greatest reverse hijacking tool? And what I would recommend is, rather than digging into that now, and I see that we've just gone over our allotted time, is that we have a healthy discussion on the list, and really looking for non-registry, non-registrar input on this idea. So from the folks from the IPC and the VC, CBUC, and all the folks from the at-large and the folks that are not registry and registrars on this call, I think we could really use your help fleshing out this idea that, what are your concerns? Or, let's game test this a little bit as far as how this could be abused on the list. Anybody, any volunteers to poke this process with sharp sticks and pretend that they're a black hat hijacker and try to break it? Who volunteers?
I was going to volunteer Collins. He sounds like a black hat kind of guy.
Well, here's the thing, is that if nobody volunteers,
I'm going to get out of that reputation.
But I'm going to assume that everybody believes this thing is ironclad and perfect if nobody volunteers. So,
well, this is Kevin Erdman. I'll volunteer to take a first poke at trying to exploit some vulnerability in it, as long as people promise to tear into it and tell me why I'm wrong.
That would be excellent, Kevin. And I think that anything that we can do to close any loopholes or tighten up any loose language that might undermine this whole process, I think would be very productive and very helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
And, of course, the sub-team, which is McKelly, myself, Paul, Mikey, and Barbara, are at your disposal if you have questions of intent or, why it says what it says, I guess.
All right. Very good. I will put on my black hat and try to figure out how to bust it open.
Okay. I think that's a useful exercise. Thank you. I think that will go a long way too. And then I think we'll receive even more when we put this out into the wild for comments.
No doubt.
So with that said, it's now 10:03 Central Time, which means 3 minutes after our allotted hour. If there are no additional orders of business, we can conclude this week and then await McKaylee's return. I only hope he is well-rested and recovered from his ordeal there in Milan.
Poor guy.
I know. it's sad.
I get lost in Palermo and never get back.
Well, hopefully he can come back and he'll be pleased with what we were able to achieve today. And I will review the MP3 and the transcript once those are posted and try to capture some of the things that we've said in this draft. And then we can keep driving towards that May 31st date for an initial report.
Cool beans. Thanks, James. Great.
Right. Thanks, James.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a good morning. Good afternoon.
Bye now.
Bye.
Bye.